Next case is 06514 in the matter of Donald Atkins Jr. Is that federally?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Kate Faderly, and I, along with co-counsel Jason Mackey, represent Amicus Curiae, the Justice for Children Project at the Moritz College of Law. Counsel for appellant has allotted us the first 5 minutes of his time. I will be addressing the due process issue, and counsel for appellant will argue the equal protection issue as well as some other issues. Appellant has also asked that 2 minutes be reserved of his argument time for rebuttal. It does seem, Your Honors, that the parties are in agreement here that there is a fundamental liberty interest that is implicated by the decision to terminate parental rights. Both the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have repeatedly recognized that parents have a fundamental liberty interest in the care, custody, and control of their children. Despite the state's claims to the contrary, this court in In re Williams recognized that the child also has due process rights that are implicated by the termination decision. Those interests, of course, are similar to those of the parents because the child has these same interests in preserving the integrity of the family unit. At a minimum, however, it is clear that the familial relationships here are entitled to constitutional protection under the Due Process Clause. The state also agrees that 2151.414E2 must be read to mean that mental retardation alone is insufficient to terminate parental rights. Thus, apparently the disagreement between the parties stems from the application of this statute to this family. The statute as applied here violates the due process rights of both the parents and the child, and clearly of the family unit. Under 2151.413, the state must file a motion seeking permanent custody. It is not clear from the record what the basis was for that motion. In closing, however, the state did argue that under the statute, the child had been in custody for 12 months and that they needed to move forward with some permanency. Clearly, of course, 2151.414B1D, the 12 of 22 month provision, could not apply here given this court's decision in CW. And of course, the appellate district, the Fifth District, recognized this. The Fifth District thus concluded that we must be proceeding under 2151.414B1A, where the child has not been abandoned, orphaned, nor in the care of the state for 12 of 22 months and cannot be placed with either of the parents. The question then is whether under 2151.414E, there is clear and convincing evidence of one or more of those enumerated factors in the statute. The trial court's judgment entry here, which is less than clear, leads us to a result that is unconstitutional, is inconsistent with statutory language, and lacks adequate factual support. First, the trial court found that both parents failed continually and repeatedly for a period of 6 months or more to substantially remedy the conditions causing removal. Apparently, the trial court was referring to a 6-month limitation on parents under an older version of the statute that had been amended by the legislature 10 years earlier. Second, the lower court's findings were not supported by the record. Under 2151.414E1, in determining whether parents have substantially remedied the conditions causing the removal, the court shall consider the parents' utilization of services like medical, psychiatric, psychological, and other social and rehabilitative services, and that those material resources were made available to the parents for the purpose of changing parental conduct. The record abundantly demonstrates that the parents completed all aspects of the case plan. They first completed the required psychological evaluations. They were assessed for services by MRDD, and in fact, MRDD found they were not qualified for services because they were able to adapt and maintain adequate housing. They were also to participate in therapy as recommended, which the mother was doing. The father apparently was not because those services would not be available for 3 to 6 months. Moreover, they did attend parenting classes, which the state stopped after 8 or 9 sessions because the worker felt the parents were not internalizing the lessons because of their mental retardation. Third, the real problem was not the parents' failure to avail themselves of services. It was the failure of the state to make diligent efforts to work toward reunification as is required under 2151-414E1. The state prematurely terminated services it felt were not working rather than provide the family with more appropriate services. Fourth, the state improperly terminated on the basis of mental retardation that was neither so severe nor so debilitating as to fall within the language of 2151.
These items sound to me like an abuse of discretion rather than a constitutional issue presented.
Your Honor, the issue here is both a constitutional one as well as a review of the court's finding on clear and convincing evidence. It is clear that should this case be permitted to go forward, the parents' rights were terminated solely on the basis of mental retardation. That is inadequate under the statute. It also violates the Constitution. As you know, we don't have requirements for anyone to be a parent ab initio. Rather, the parents must serve as adequate parents. We do not have a record below that indicates they were inadequate parents. What we do have in the record below is that they had mental retardation. That is not sufficient, both as a matter of statutory and constitutional law. Certainly, it would not be, in my view, an abuse of discretion standard on appeal, because I believe that the judgment has to be supported by some competent, credible evidence going to all essential elements of the case.
But Counselor, look, just for the record, the Adkins initiated contact with Children's Services here.
Correct.
And voluntarily surrendered the child because of some dysfunction that was happening within the home.
Correct.
Okay. So the requirement now to terminate Children's Services involvement as far as custody and return the child, you would agree, has to be done under an umbrella of scrutiny. They can't automatically, just because the parents say, okay, we've changed our mind, we want him back. Because, you know, they started the ball rolling, so to speak, and the involvement with the agency. And the agency could not, without a proper evaluation, determination, home study, sociological, whatever, terminate their custody of this child and return him to the parents. Would you agree with that?
Your Honor, actually, I disagree to the extent that it panned out exactly in the way the court's articulating. We do have a voluntary surrender, which became an involuntary surrender once the state stepped in and filed a petition. The child was then found to be dependent. The state then, during a period of time, provided services. I would note for the court that the parenting began in August of 2004 and was terminated in September of 2004. No further parenting classes were provided. The state then filed its motion to terminate in January of 2005. The question then becomes whether or not, if this court reverses, what will happen with the child. There is no reason to believe the child has to be returned to the parents, that rather this child is still found dependent and the state may then proceed to provide the appropriate services. So I would disagree with the court that the end result would be that the state has to step away from the case. Rather, what we are arguing is that the state has to provide the appropriate services before termination can be put in place. I believe I've used up my 5 minutes, Your Honor. Have I answered your question?
Thank you.
I have one question for you before you leave, and that has to do with the crux of the issue, as I'm understanding it, is that the state failed to provide the services, but that the court stepped in before those services had been fully delivered to the parents.
That's correct,
Your
Honor.
Is that the due process violation that you're arguing to us, as opposed to the abuse of discretion the Chief asked about?
Actually, Your Honor, what we are arguing is that the basis for the termination on the part of the court was solely the evidence of mental retardation. And because we don't have any additional evidence, as required under the statute and the Constitution, that the mental retardation was so severe as to prevent them from providing an adequate home, that amounted to the due process violation. Did I answer your question?
Is that a discretionary determination by the court, then?
No, Your Honor, it is
not. As to the degree of retardation?
No, Your Honor, I would argue it's not under these circumstances because, again, it's not simply the degree of retardation. It's their inability to parent here that's critical, and we don't actually have clear and convincing evidence below of their inability to parent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Federley. Mr. Caro.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Jadine Caro. I'm counsel for the appellants in this case, Mrs. Bertha Atkins and Mr. Donald Atkins, Sr. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Your Honor, before I begin my argument, I'd like to address a question asked by Justice O'Donnell. Justice O'Donnell, you asked whether the court had stepped in, thereby preventing any further educational aspects. Actually, what happened here is the state agency changed the program of education. Initially, my clients were supposed to go through a group training session of 8. Now it's a 10-week session. They terminated that in exchange for having a one-on-one, a half hour before the visitation with the child, a half hour after. The intention was to have hands-on instruction. That never came about. So in a sense, the court didn't terminate before they were able to do it. They never did it. Your Honor, there are three.
Counsel, is it alleged that stopped because it was becoming ineffective? They weren't making any headway. There had to be an alternative, or did they just stop it and then immediately proceed with no alternative other than court action with the child?
Your Honor, they did about 8 weeks of this one-on-one, half hour before, half hour after, so 8 times. The view of Ms. Whitney, Ms. Bertini, the agency's employees, was that my clients were not learning fast enough. In contrast to that, if we look at Dr. Misra's testimony at page 11, Dr. Misra was the psychologist who did the psychological assessment, the psychological evaluation. Our problem with him is, on the one hand, he seems to focus almost exclusively on the cognitive deficiencies. Where, on the other hand, however, he says, they are concretists. My clients are concretists, meaning that they think in concrete terms. While recognizing that they need one-on-one instruction and that they need the hands-on direction, the agency failed to provide that. So on the one hand, Dr. Misra focuses almost exclusively on cognitive deficiency, and he fails to recognize the other aspect of a modern view of mental deficiency.
So would you agree that what you're seeking here is a continuation of services adapted, tailored for this particular family unit, not necessarily a return of the child to the family unit absent these services?
Your Honor, the question you posed initially was accurate. My clients sought help. They voluntarily surrendered their child. But the help that they needed did not necessarily trigger the interests of the government under Chapter 2151. And our argument is this, that certainly we're asking the court to reverse the decision below and allow the family to be reunited. That there's no denial of that. We would like to have some type of educational program, some type of parenting skills program. But ultimately, we see a constitutional defect in this case, primarily because as we look at parental termination cases dealing with discipline problems, we see that those cases where termination occurs also have a cognizable, an objective manifestation of a risk of harm to the child. We see none of that here. What we see here is the child is properly clothed, the child is properly housed, properly fed, and there's no manifestation in school that he's acting out inappropriately, he's not been declared delinquent, he's not hurt anyone, nor have my clients hurt them, him. Our position, therefore, is this, that in terms of an equal protection argument, certainly we have the federal constitutional guaranteed right, the right to raise your family, as acknowledged by amicus. But what we also have are two units of parents similarly situated. Unit one is a mentally proficient parent, and both groups have parental discipline problems. Group two, which is my clients, are mentally deficient. The mentally proficient family would never lose the right of custody to their child. And we can find no case in the state of Ohio where a parental discipline problem without some outward manifestation of harm to the child resulted in termination. So we would submit to the court that very much like the City of Cleburne case, the United States Supreme Court case of 1985, what we have here is an irrational prejudice against those who are mentally retarded.
But how is it that the statute provides, and I think the court found, that the degree of mental retardation or emotional illness is so severe that it makes the parents unable to provide for the home? And why isn't that determination by the trial court then an abuse of discretion, as the Chief Justice suggested? And why isn't that what level of review we apply here?
Your Honor, we have not attacked the statute on its face. We have attacked the statute as applied by the trial court. We can certainly envision severely, profoundly retarded individuals who could not care for their children. And those are the types of cases we see with mental retardation. My clients are what are classified as mildly retarded. That their IQ is between 50 and 70. Mrs. Atkins has a 59. Mr. Atkins has a 62. Mildly retarded is not the only criterion, however. What the AAMD says, the association that deals with this issue, what they say is you have to look at adaptive behavior. Our primary problem is the trial court never looked at the actual ability of my clients to parent their children. It simply focused on Dr. Misra saying their IQ was low. And Dr. Misra in his testimony says, I don't believe in cognitive behavior therapy. I don't believe that they can ever learn. That is in conflict with the association that studies this type of issue.
So therefore, with respect to this issue, where is the constitutional deprivation that that you're raising for us?
The amicus is raising a due process claim, Your Honor. We're arguing equal protection. And we're saying we have two similarly situated groups of people. But for the retardation, we would never have lost custody of our child. Only because of the retardation is that happening. And given the fact that there is an absence of risk of harm to the child, that's unconstitutional. Now, we are arguing a strict scrutiny analysis.
Well, Counselor, the crux, I think, of the analysis by the appellate court was there might not be a problem now, but there's certainly going to be a problem in the future because this child is acting as a peer, or his parents are treating him as a peer, as opposed to a typical parent-child relationship, admitting everything else that you stated, that he's healthy, you know, developing and not at risk. But in the future, this is going to present a problem as this child grows into preteen and teenage years, and these parents aren't going to be able to handle him.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's basically the crux of why he's being taken away.
That's correct.
Or we're here today, and that's because the analysis is that as he matures, his parents will not change. They are incapable of, as was stated, internalizing the instruction, and therefore they will always stay at this level while the child needs parents that can move.
Your Honor, first of all, I don't see any indication in the General Assembly's statutes that allow for speculation as to future
improvement. And I'm not saying that there is, but I'm saying, is that a correct analysis?
That is a correct analysis of what the trial court held. Your Honor, I have difficulty with that. We could look at any number of children in poor families, and we could easily say they would be far better off in a wealthy family or in a better situation. We don't do that. We don't allow for the state to speculate as to a better home environment. And number two, I agree. My clients will need some help. That's what they did in the first place. They asked for help. They never got the help. There's no indication that the agency cannot provide the help they need, which would be that one-on-one, concrete, hands-on instruction.
Where do we get to the best interest of the child analysis in this presentation?
That's a threshold requirement, Your Honor, and the best interest in this particular case by statute was found because the child, in the court's view, could not be returned back to the home within a reasonable period of time. He could not be returned to the home within a reasonable period of time because of the deficiencies we're talking about here today. And of course, our position would be in the absence of any objective manifestation of injury to the child, the state has no interest. And so whether you apply strict scrutiny or a rational basis, they can't prevail. They have no interest in the internal domestic discipline of that home. What we're talking about, Your Honor, Justice O'Connor, you mentioned the peer issue. This was a problem between the father, Mr. Atkins, and the son. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about juvenile things. He's not the primary disciplinarian. Mrs. Atkins is the primary disciplinarian. And I would venture to say, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if fathers and their sons had a friendship relationship? And that really comes to the last point I would like to make, and that is everybody recognized that there was a great deal of love and affection mutually. The child wants to come back, and my clients want the child. The statute doesn't talk about love. I know it doesn't talk about love. But love is the formation of the family. Love is the foundation of the family. My clients love their child. They will do everything they possibly can, self-sacrifice, self-improvement, to get the child back.
Just a quick follow-up on that. You know, how much do the rights of the child in this case come into play in the thrust of your argument? And what was the analysis of the trial court in regards to that?
Your Honor, we did not make that argument below. The argument on the constitutional issue in the best interest, the due process claim, was suggested by the court. We briefed that pursuant to the court. Okay. We didn't make that argument. Okay. Your Honor, I believe my
time is
up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. Haverfield.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, David Haverfield here on behalf of Tuscarawas County Job and Family Services. I would respectfully disagree with much of the presentation by appellants here in regard to the efforts that Job and Family Services provided. I think if you look at the record below, the agency went above and beyond what's legally required to provide these parents an opportunity to reunify with their child. The record indicates that group parenting was started with them and it didn't work. Their cognitive limitations were such that was not going to be effective. So the agency started individualized education with them before and after their visits in the hopes of working with them to incorporate those skills into those visits. That did not work because unfortunately their cognitive limitations did not allow them to understand and internalize those things. That's why the parent education was stopped. On top of that, they were—
How many times did they do the in-home work?
It never got to a point of in-home. They did visitation at the agency.
That's the problem I've got with your argument. You argue that they didn't work in a group setting, so they did a home setting. But the reality is they never did the home setting, so nobody can really evaluate that, and yet they use that as a basis to say they can't do this.
It didn't go into the home. It took place around their visitations, which remained supervised at the agency by direction of the juvenile court.
And yet the plan called for in-home training, which was never done, and yet part of the basis for the decision is they failed in-home training. Isn't that sort of circuitous?
Some in-home training started in the foster home where Donald was placed. These parents went to that foster home. It was a foster parent with 30 years of experience. The idea of working with them in a less threatening environment to work on parenting their child. Fortunately, things happened in that home that did not allow that to continue. And from the agency's perspective, we tried every possible alternative to provide those services to the parents.
What other alternative did you try?
We referred them again to a third parent education program, which they testified at the permanent custody hearing.
What was that program?
It was a program at Cornerstone Support Services, which is a local facility that provides help to—
What happened to that program?
They testified they completed it. They testified they finished the program. There's also testimony in the record from the person at the agency that did their parent education that when she discussed with them some of the things covered in those sessions, they had absolutely no idea what any of those concepts were. That's in the record from the trial court below. Your Honors, I would submit that the standard here is reasonable efforts. I think the agency expended reasonable efforts. Certainly, there's always more that could have been done, and courts have recognized that. The standard is not, could the agency have done more, but did the agency meet its legal burden?
Counsel, let me ask you the same, or plow some of the same field that I did with Mr. Carroll. Is this an anticipatory judgment and analysis that things might be okay at this point with some supervision, but as this child grows and matures, he's going to so far outdistance his parents that they will not be able to cope in a traditional parent-child relationship, and who knows what danger that will bring?
Thank you. In some ways, I think it is. I think the court looked at the current circumstances and the future circumstances. I would disagree with Dean Carroll. There was a lot of evidence in the record below, not only that the parental rights were terminated because they were mentally retarded, but it also focused on some of the conditions of the child. It talked about their interactions in visitation, their inability to comprehend things, some concerns about their interaction with other people, as well as the testimony.
But those interactions and that analysis, if valid, didn't affect this child's ability to be healthy, to be well cared for, to be clothed, to be sheltered, to attend school. to have an adjustment, you know, with the unit, the parents. Mm-hmm. None of that was negatively affected at the current time. Would you agree?
I would not necessarily agree at the time the child was removed.
No, there was an aggression issue with the mother, but that happens with all kids. You know, we're not experiencing anything there that's unusual, whether you've got a mentally retarded set of parents or you just have a, you know.
And I think there's some disagreement about that in the record. The testimony of the agency's worker was that mom called up and said, you need to get this child out of here before I'm going to hurt him. That's the what the record below demonstrates.
And if I called CSB every time I felt that way about my kids, you know, or any parent. Actually, to me, that looks like a responsible action on the mother's part to recognize that there's an aggression level there that I need to deal with.
Certainly, and I think the court was being prospective. I think at the time this case started, that's exactly what was starting to happen, is that this young man who, from the record below, is a young man of normal intelligence. Certainly he has some mm-hmm. behavioral issues, but nothing beyond the spectrum of what we see in a lot of children. And the peer relationship sort of demonstrates what was happening. This child was surpassing the parents' ability to manage him. He was becoming the parent. They were becoming the children. So that certainly is going to continue to worsen, particularly in light of Dr. Misra's testimony that even if we find this program, even if they successfully complete it, do everything asked of them, we're going to see maybe a little bit of a change, but not really much.
Well, there's a whole lot of parents that, as their children get older, develop a total inability to relate and deal with their children. We don't take their children away because of that. Why do we in this case? The child's able to function in school, the child's doing well in school. The child can certainly get a lot of those interactions in school, as many normal teenagers do that don't get along with their parents. Why does that make these parents unfit?
I think there's a distinction between inability to relate to a child as they get older or some problems there, and having a child that intellectually has surpassed the parents to the point that the roles are reversed, and that's what the court was looking at here.
So if someone is blind and as the child gets older, the child starts helping out the parent more. That's a reason to take the child away, because the child's outdistancing the parent in ability to deal with the world?
I think blindness it would be a separate issue. We're not faced with one limitation here. We're talking about severe limitations that affect their ability to relate to raise, to parent, to protect, to do all those things that the parents are required to do here.
What specifics are in evidence that we could look at in support of what you just said? What inabilities? Is this a future, like it's going to get worse, so I'm going to guard against that? I mean, what is it in the record that it appears as though the parents have said, we need some guidance and we need some assistance. They started to get some guidance and assistance, and then all of a sudden everybody said, oh, no, I think we ought to go the other way. And then they lost custody of their child.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would point to several places that we outlined in our brief in the transcript. Dr. Misra's testimony, particularly about their cognitive limitations, what his concerns would be about ability to change, ability to parent this child, ability to adapt and manage. There's also testimony.
Now you're making the argument, I think, that Ms. Federley argued to us that this is done because of mental retardation, and that's unconstitutional.
On one level, the mental retardation does play in here. I mean, the statute clearly outlines that if the parent's mental retardation is so severe that they'll be unable to parent the child.
If that is the sole singular reason, do you agree that that's unconstitutional?
I would agree. If the only evidence here was mental retardation, nothing else in the record beyond that, I would agree that that would be a constitutional problem, as several cases cited by Ms. Federley from other states have held. But that's not this case. There's other evidence in the record.
That's what I just asked you. What is it? First thing you went to was the fact of limited cognitive ability.
Right, but there's also manifestation in the record, I think, as well, of other factors here.
Thank you.
Just to pick up on Justice O'Connor's questions, it seems to me the difficult question issue for us is found in paragraph 6 of the trial court's mm-hmm. findings of fact. To expect a normally functioning child like Donald Jr. to be parented by two parents with the severe limitations demonstrated by Mr. and Mrs. Atkins is to seriously jeopardize his healthy, successful future. So looking at the best interest of the child, taking out the constitutional issue, looking at the best interest of the child, the trial court here is saying these parents have a level of mental acumen that won't change. And the child, as the child develops, the parent's ability to parent. I mean, the fact that the parents act like a peer with the child, of course the child wants to go back to the home. That, what child wouldn't if their parents acted like a peer instead of a parent? So the trial court is saying that in the best interest of this child, I'm going to remove him from this home, even though today he's being fed and clothed and being given all the basic essentials of life. And so the statute doesn't seem to tell us what to do in a situation like this, does it?
No, and that's why I would suggest some deference be given to the trial court. The trial judge saw these parents, heard the evidence firsthand, assessed the situation, dealt with these real people in a real situation, and I would suggest that some deference be due to the trial court in that circumstance. And going back to some of the issues from before, you know, a dependency finding was made here. The parents never appealed that. They never objected to that. They never challenged the trial court's finding after a trial that this child was dependent under the statute. And further, with regard to the services that were provided, they never challenged that either. Every hearing throughout this case, and the record shows there were numerous hearings.
Was there a challenge when the other two children were taken from the home, from Atkins' home?
No, the other two children, historically, that was probably 7 to 10 years prior to this child. Those are older children. No, permanent custody was granted of one of those children. The other child aged out of our foster care system in a planned permanent living arrangement. But in terms of the case plan, the parents never objected. It was repeatedly before the court for review. The court repeatedly made findings that the case plan was appropriate and met their needs. It wasn't until the permanent custody trial that the parents came forward and said, wait a second, this case plan isn't right. So in some ways, it's difficult for the agency to tailor a case plan when going along the judgment of the court, the parents aren't objecting. It's as if the case plan is appropriate. So the agency is in a difficult position there. Your Honors, I would just suggest that there is certainly not an equal protection violation here. The United States Supreme Court had an opportunity to declare mentally retarded persons as a suspect class. They chose not to do that. With regard to the due process argument, they're not challenging the statute facially as being unconstitutional. They're challenging the application. I would suggest in this case that the application was appropriate. State certainly has a very strong interest, in the protection of children. By virtue of the dependency finding, the state certainly has an interest in what happens with these children, and that the processes outlined in the statute were fair and appropriate, and that the trial court's findings were appropriate as well. I would ask the court to affirm the decision.
It doesn't appear that the trial court gave much of an analysis to the wishes of the child, you know, in the guardian ad litem's report. How much impact should, you know, the fundamental rights of the child in regards to maintaining family relationships have in this particular case? And
certainly it does have a significant impact, and the agency recognized that. It was the agency that asked the court to appoint separate counsel for Donald. After the petition was filed for permanent custody, the agency, who deals with this child on a regular basis, knew he did not want to go to permanent custody. So we asked the court to appoint counsel for him. Counsel advocated at the permanent custody hearing against termination, filed a separate appeal on Donald's behalf in the Fifth District. So I think the trial court was presented with Donald's viewpoint and did consider it. I understand that the judge did not outline that very well in the opinion, but certainly there was plenty of evidence in the record at the termination hearing. Donald's interests were represented.
Well, although the judge didn't outline it, why didn't it have an impact? Why does these other factors outweigh?
I don't know that they do. The statute on best interest requires the court to take into consideration the child's wishes as expressed directly or through the guardian. And certainly the trial court's decision doesn't detail what factor it weighed more than another, but certainly the evidence was in the record and the trial court was able to consider that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Haverfield. Mr. Carroll or Mr. Carroll, you've used your time to maybe take 30 seconds.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, I have two brief points on rebuttal. First, there was an indication that my clients went to the Cornerstone program. The record does not reveal anything about what that program entailed, whether they passed, whether they failed, or anything at all. So we simply have the fact that they went to the program. And second, Justice O'Donnell, you asked, what manifestation on the record is there of a parental problem dealing with the children? The caseworkers in this case testified that at some of the visitations, Mrs. Atkins would whisper to the child that at a time she raised her voice, and in another occasion she discussed a medical issue. Those don't strike me as indications of parental problems. Specifically, for example, the medical issue was not a gynecological issue that was inappropriate to discuss with an 11-year-old boy. She was having knee surgery. So none of those indications reflect an inability to parent, which is the core of the state's case. We would ask the court to reverse the decision below, to honor the wishes of the child, allow him to be reunited with his family, and allow the family to be reunited finally. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.